IsraelUnite.org. For any on YouTube, you can type in IUIC Chicago or whatever city or state that you're in. You can type in your city, IUIC in the city, and you'll see a line of our videos coming up, come up, where you can get in contact and connect with us.
We thank you guys, man, for coming down to Blazing the studio again. You guys been listening to 91.1 FM WEFT, and we bid you have a nice week, and see you guys next week, or listen to you guys next week.
Good morning, dedicated listeners. You are listening to community programming on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, when it's not completely frozen. Also streaming online at weft.org. Web programs can be restreamed on spinitron.com for up to 2 weeks. Opinions expressed on WEFT are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Prairie Air Incorporated or other station volunteers. Today's program is the Christmas Day 2022 edition of the Prairie Monk program. My name is Bill Saylor. I am continuing our memorial of Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, who passed away just this past December 2nd at the age of 91. Some 60 of those years spent living and working in and around Champaign-Urbana, trying to foster its remnant native ecosystem. Today I have archive selections of two favorite topics that Dave would sometimes present seasonally that I always found especially interesting from his unique personal history. In the first half, we remember longtime friends, some now since passed. I am sharing it for those who are still with us. We begin with our show recorded December 21st, 1997. That was live on air with guests in the WEFT Great Hall.
Blue railroad train and going down the railroad track. It makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line.
And this is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial. And a Merry Christmas to you all. This is the time for gathering together and being friendly and renewing friendships and enjoying each other. And in that whole process, we've been putting together a little storefront next door down the road. We found that the place was vacant and asked if we could occupy it, and the owners very kindly have donated the space for this season. A place from which we hope to extend ideas to allow you to encounter some of the projects that we're involved with and to enjoy same. We're bringing out of the woodwork a lot of teaching materials and past events, the records of same, to make this we hope, an interesting place. We've had lots of people pop in and help. We had a fundraiser, which is also helping. Michelle Matkovich has been organizing that. We have had Nancy Rubel, who is next door on the other side, and she's come over and worked for a long time to tidy up the concept so that we don't get too monkey and too junky and too grotto-like. It has to be somewhat organized. And WEFTies have been helping by announcing same. Kent came in last night, and he'd been in there many times to visit people at the web, and he was amazed to see what was going on. Came back and said, hey, why don't you come over for a minute and announce your things? And other people have been reading The Octopus, and other people have been announcing for us. We are selling a few things, but that's a minor detail, that will not be the main thrust of the story. It will be to share the information that we've gathered over the many years. We also hope it will facilitate volunteerism so that people can come in and have a place to do their own thing without us breathing down their neck. We'll keep our own facility up the road and do our basic work from there. So we're looking for community action, and we're soliciting your involvement. In that vein, we had three friends come in the other day. They have been friends for many years, some from where we've lived together. I used to live on Green Street, where McDonald's now is, and so some of us have come from that association. Others have come from Cosmopolitan Club and the and English as a Second Language, and a number of different relationships. So I want to introduce Susan Taylor, who's on our Heartland Pathways board, and Carlene Ansbach, who's been here for many years and did live at 624 East Green, and Mary Hussey, who the last event that we had Mary Hussey involved with was a program we did with the film I'd Be Delighted, and Mary was featured as a dancer in a different period, and Amy Berger was here talking about that. So there's lots of associations here. I would like to have them tell you a little bit about how they came to be here, what their interests are, why they're interested in this particular type of environmental work. And I start with Susan Taylor.
It's a privilege to be here in the WEF studios with Dave, whose program we like to listen to on Sunday mornings at 11:30. And the three of us are a little nervous here, but we hope we'll come through okay. Before I get into what I want to say, Dave, what's the address of the new adjunct spot?
It's just ERES is on the north side of WEF, and the new facility is on the south side. It's 111.
111.
North Market.
North of University Avenue here on Market Street.
Yes.
Some of you may not know, it's quite a little street here of buzzing activity.
Yes, even in late into the night.
Late into the night. I do believe the three of us were here until nearly midnight this week. and so we've been invited back again on Sunday morning.
We even shared some Australian slide.
That was
it's interesting that Barry Barker used to occupy the same space many years ago, and it was with him that we went to Australia and took some of the pictures that we were looking at.
1989, I believe, was when I was last in number 111, and Barry Barker was signing me up for this two-week photographic shoot in Dave's home territory of Australia. It was a terrific trip, and we finally got to looking at some of the pictures Thursday night. So anyway, I'm Susan Taylor, and I trace my interest in what goes on around out in the fields here to having grown up on a 500-acre farm 30 miles from New York City, which most people don't think about as being 30 miles from New York City these days. But my grandfather, who was a New Englander, and my grandmother were transplanted from Boston to Manhattan for my grandfather's business, which was in the cotton goods. Actually, he always went back to Boston, even though his main office was in New York, on New Year's, because he thought it was terribly silly to have two holidays in the same period there of Christmas and New Year's, and Boston didn't observe New Year's Day as a holiday, so Grandfather would go back to Boston and do business on New Year's Day to keep going. But anyway, they liked to get out of New York City, and they had a home on 11th Street in New York, In the summer, they particularly like to get out with their young family. My mother was one of six children, siblings, and she had a terrific love of the land, and I think really that's where mine comes from. And for me, I came to Illinois in 1962 for 1 year, and the reason I came was that my oldest sister was coming east from California. Her husband had changed jobs from teaching at Stanford to the chair of the political science department at SUNY Stony Brook, and I thought the house was getting a little full, so I came out to see what the Midwest looked like for a year, and here I am, and it's only 35 years later, but it's because I'm still in the country. Long Island is now cars and houses, and there isn't that much in the way of potatoes and cabbages that I was used to. So
and your farm has been cut up and sold.
And the farm has been cut up and sold, except for 4 acres where my sister's still in the house that was built in 1810 that I grew up in. Grandpa came along in about 1905 and bought it, 1900, well, anyway, somewhere in there. Uh-huh. So that was a Jones family, and if any of you are Easterners who are listening, it was Jones Beach Jones, and they owned 15 miles across Long Island and all the mosquitoes that went with it.
Okay, well, you might give some reaction of the specific...
The space at 111 was fun to get in there last night before last, whenever it was, to see the... just to be able to walk around in it, shall we say. We know 115 North Market, and it's a little hard to maneuver in there.
A horizontal nightmare, shall we say.
But the openness of this space at 111 is very inviting, and I think Carlene's going to talk more about that, so
okay.
I'll turn that to her.
Well, next we turn over to Mary Hussey, who grew up near to Springfield, near Riverton, and then she has spent some time in Monticello, so I'll leave to you to say who you are.
Thank you, Dave. And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, everybody. I am a native of Illinois. As David said, I came from near Springfield. You may have heard of the towns of Williamsville and Riverton. I came from about halfway in between those two. And my family on all sides were farmers. And I come from a very distinctly farm background. And I suppose that is the reason I have a great interest in this whole thing, in environmentalism. David mentioned that I was in English as a second language. That's true. I taught there for a while. I also spent 14 years teaching in Monticello, teaching in high school. I'm interested in all of this area, just as I would be interested in my own home area if I were there. To speak a little bit about the place here where we are, I came here night before last with Susan and Carlene, and I must say that I was surprised and gratified by the appearance of the whole place. It's extremely interesting. David has a room for this and a room for that and a room for something else everywhere. Is there anything else you'd like me to say, David?
No, I think I like what your relationship to the Monticello area, especially. You know all the people that are there, some of the Pyatts and some of the people who move and shake things today.
Yes. I know of different families and know some of them, yes. And, of course, the same goes for back home in Sangamon County. So I just like this area. I have never wanted to live anywhere else except here. I've been around quite a bit, but I always like to come back here.
Afghanistan and Columbia, spots that some of us don't know so well.
I did have some teaching assignments in Afghanistan, which was quite a, and Columbia and Mexico.
Now, Colleen.
Well, my area is fashion design, and I also have a consumer economic degree, so when I went in this shop of David's, and I've named it the Prairie Land Boutique.
Well, we do have T-shirts and
clothing. He has used a lot of the Prairie designs, some in clothing. And, of course, I was very interested. And a particular interesting one was a lavender full circular skirt. With what's that flower?
Echinacea.
The purple coneflower printed around the bottom and in a rich ochre brown, and then put with one of his T-shirts in a sage green with black printed grass, the grasses of the pear.
Grow it, don't mow it.
Oh, that didn't say don't mow it, though. This is, he has that cute shirt that says grow it, don't mow it. But this was, these were the real prairie grasses going up the front. And it was a very smart-looking outfit. I said it could have passed for much, much higher than he was asking for it. And so he has done a lot of clever things in that shop. Even if you were not interested in the prairie. But anyway, back to the prairie. My original home is Iowa, and I have to comment. In Iowa, they made an instant prairie. They took 3,000 acres of land and plowed it up and planted the prairie.
Yes.
And they planted buffalo in it, real live buffalo, and deer, and the grass in that good Iowa soil got so tall that nobody can see the buffalo. but that's their instant prairie.
We have been more into saving prairie than we have been into
making prairie.
Making prairie.
Yes,
because
here.
It's more natural, yes.
Yeah, but they're into making them.
You had a father and an uncle who were doctors, and they were in Iowa where there were springs.
And oh, yes. The town that I come from is Colfax, between Des Moines. I always have to say where it is, Des Moines and Newton. And it was a mineral spring spa town in its day. It had 14 doctors and many big hotels. Then they went out of fashion. It had its own railroad that went up to the main big hotel they had there. And it was a fashion spot, and they had lots of fun as long as taking their treatments for rheumatism and so forth. And so then it went out of fashion. It went out of style. And that was the end of the era of the spas. But nobody saved them like Save the Prairie. They didn't save those spas. But
I suspect the spas are still there if you wanted to activate them. They've gone out of fashion.
And I may say that there's a man there that last year is trying to bring back the mineral springs. That's right. And he's bottling it, you know, mm-hmm. and trying to sell it in a big way. And he dug a new well. Yes, they're there. Yeah. And I remember my father had a sanitarium, and it had a well. You could pump the water in the sanitarium, and we didn't like it. We didn't drink the water because it sort of was a laxative in a way. It was a laxative. Yes.
And today, it had minerals in it, right? Yeah. Artesian water.
Today, it's still a laxative.
Well, okay, now we have established ourselves. I would like to say that these three people have all had some associations with the Southern Tea Rooms, and some of you don't know what the Southern Tea Rooms were. But they were a big old house which preceded the...
McDonald's,
yes. And they were... it was a house that was taller than the Follett's next door. And the Southern Tea Rooms were a meeting place for the Board of Trustees before there was a union. And two sisters put this together, Mrs. Baines and Mrs. Smith. Mm-hmm. And Mrs. Smith was the operational person, more or less, and Mrs. Baines was somewhat more on the arty side. She was to paint pictures of their home base. They came from Lebanon, Tennessee.
Also the front woman.
Yes. And this was right on Green Street, and it was very fashionable. You had to have tie and gloves on if you were going to attend, and sometimes you had to wait in the Rose Garden. And there was a Tiffany-era frontispiece with a grand piano and the appropriate canary in the cage and the violinist and what have you. And when the union opened, it was no longer as functional as a restaurant. It became cut up into apartments, and Susan and Carleen lived in the Southern Tea Rooms. And then McDonald's came along and took a 99-year lease on the site, and the building came down. So we are watching our own history right alongside, and documentation of that sort of thing is the sort of thing we'd like to do with this new facility. Well, Carleen and Susan and Mary, thank you very much for coming by. And
it was a pleasure.
We enjoyed ourselves. Thank you.
It was fun.
Right. It's not always easy to come and be on the air, but WEFT is very friendly. We try not to frighten you with our radio broadcasts.
But who's frightened?
That was Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk and friends, from our broadcast on December 21st, 1997, here on WEFT Radio, 25 years ago. The boutique they were describing was basically a gallery that Dave had set up for a short time at 111 North Market Street, which had lots of little rooms in it, organized into thematic presentations of Dave's work. The slides of Australia mentioned were indeed the ones Dave had developed after the rolls of film had been sequestered in the fridge for 7 years after the photos were taken on the trip, prompting a wonderful viewing party at the time with fellow travelers and friends of Monk. Next, we have a more detailed description of the Southern Tea Rooms and subsequent apartments, where Dave and his wife Jan and various friends lived in the 1960s on the 600 block of East Green Street in Campustown. This is from a Prairie Monk program that aired 5 years ago on June 25th, 2017.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champagne 90.1 on your FM dial. Today I want to say something about Kay Aston. Kay Aston just turned 100, which is quite something. And Kay has been head of English as a Second Language, retired from there. And she is in the Inman Building, which is around the corner from Weft. It's where people can retire and receive assisted living. So there was a celebration, and there was a mixture of people from academia and people who are caregivers. Kay grew up in Kansas. Her family had an English background, if I believe rightly, and had farmland in central Kansas, sort of on rolling hills. And she got her undergraduate degree from Lawrence, Kansas, and University of Kansas, and went on to Bryn Mawr in Pennsylvania. Got her doctorate there, and in between some time, she was in Japan and sorted out her thesis, and eventually was invited to come to Illinois. She was part of an organization called the Teaching of English as a Second Language. Let me go back a little bit. After World War II, there was an influx of GI people who needed to do course upgrades in English, and but they were in the same classes as people being invited from overseas who had had some English background to get here in the first place, but needed to be taught differently from the GI people. The GI people were older, they'd had an experience, and they were about to be taught properly in their terms, because they'd had that experience of driving tanks and organizing people, and they wanted to get on with it. The English as a second language people were often from other countries with ethnic differences, and so Mary Hussey and another lady, I forget her name, but they went together to suggest to the English department, or the modern languages department, I don't know which, that there should be a special unit called the Teaching of English as a Second Language, and they did that. When they were retired, they invited Kay to be a member of the department, and she came from those somewhat rolling hills of Kansas to Illinois, and she thought it was so flat. She wondered how long she was going to stay here, but she stayed here for a long time. So she has supporters. One of them is Susan Taylor, whom we know well. So there's a team of people that teach this subject matter. And I happen to, my wife Jan and I, lived in a building next door to Follett's on campus. It's very near the corner of Wright Street and Green, about 100 yards from the present location of the alma mater. I'm not sure how Kay got to that set of apartments. It was a fraternity that had fallen out in the Depression era, and the Dallenbaugh family had bought it and used it for storage for a while. And then two women from Lebanon, Tennessee, came by, and they had a house restaurant in Havana over there, more towards Lincoln Avenue. And they thought that this would be a good place for a sophisticated restaurant. And so Mrs. Smith, who was the business person, and Daisy Baines, who was the mother of Mrs. Dallenbaugh. So Mrs. Smith was the organizer, and Daisy was the associate. She painted, and she welcomed people. She smoked with a long Tiffany-era cigarette holder, and it was rather popular with students and the like. And so these were two different people, but they were a team, and they did operate a Southern Tea Rooms in that fraternity building.
It was very popular. It was very sophisticated. It was a southern tea room, and you dressed appropriately with tie and coat, and probably the women had to have gloves. It was where the Board of Trustees met when there was no union. And so they met for years there. Let's go back to the fraternity era. This was a large fraternity house. It was the highest building on campus. If you stood on the roof, you were looking down on Folds. A substantial building. It had a veranda that looked out over Green Street. But it was set back a little bit. There was a front lawn with a privet hedge around it and a walkway in. There was a driveway, and people would be absolutely amazed when you stopped in the middle of Green Street to drive into the driveway, and there was a lawn and garden where people would wait later for restaurants, but there had been a garage built there. And we still have the 1954 Lincoln that they used to drive and would go to a retreat in Wisconsin with it. It was a very short-based Lincoln and very powerful, so its power-to-weight ratio meant that it was used a lot in races. So, but this is part of the history of Champaign, which is coming up now that Kay used to live there. Go back to the fraternity era. You had this setback house with a front door, big glass door with an airlock, and then you walked into a foyer which was huge and tall, and there was this stairwell with wide stairs getting to narrower stairs that went upstairs, the administration building and rooms, and the live-in administrator was on the second floor, along with restrooms. And the restrooms were positively huge. Students would live dormitory style on the third floor mainly, but in other places too. But this was the tradition. You often left the windows open. In winter time, if you had happened to have a night's snow, you might just wake up with snow on your bed. The area could be cleared for a ballroom, and so the floor was hardwood floor that was good to dance on if you were doing the Charleston or something like that. The front foyer was Tiffany era style too. There's a grand piano, and George Foster, who later became a professor of art at this university, would play the violin, but other people would be guest musicians too. Would be a standard Tiffany era cat, perhaps even a bird cage with a bird. I didn't ever hear anything about a cockatoo, but sometimes you would have birds floating around that were part of the act. So when the union was built, the Board of Trustees had a boardroom meeting room there, and it was obvious that this was out of style anymore. So Mrs. Smith went round the floors lining up apartments in the fraternity era. The meal room or dining room was in on the first floor, so that had to be remodeled. And there were 16 apartments in the whole building, and they were very individualistic. They would, if they had to go around a pillar or something, the wall went around the pillar. It didn't have to necessarily be rectilinear. So you could walk in and enjoy a meal there. If you were on July 4th, the parade used to go down Green Street. And so all the friends and relatives, and I assume in the student days, the same thing. You could sit on the porch, which was probably about 3 or 4 feet higher than the street, and you could watch the parade go by. The parade no longer goes by that way, but it used to. So many of the apartment dwellers were belonged to the theater department or humanities, and Somehow Kay got to be living there, and then Susan Taylor was living there too. And at that time I had been living in Garber's, which was the dry cleaners just at the back, and I found out that there was a vacant apartment there. So we took an apartment in that lot and got to know Kay and Susan and all the others that were there. And this was really a little bit like home away from home, because we all knew each other. And some of us were local from places like St. Joe. And also there were these relationships to theater and things like that. So Kay was invited, and she was absolutely amazed. She'd grown up with gently rolling hills in Kansas, but this was flat. This was flat, 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 flat. Mm. And she didn't know whether she was going to stay a year or not, but she stayed a long time. And once again, there was all these associations that it was people.
You've just been listening to an excerpt of the Prairie Monk program that aired here on your community radio, WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, on June 25th, 2017. My name is Bill Saylor. Dave Monk would memorialize Kay Aston on the May 19th, 2019 episode after she passed. Both programs are available on YouTube, courtesy of Urbana Public Access, UPTV. The full June 25th, 2017 Prairie Monk recording is one that runs the gamut. 2 minutes after we left off there, Dave is talking about the old Sadorus Jail, and later about photographing the different prairie coneflowers. Incidentally, Dave had inherited a dress form, a bust of sorts, a model of a woman's torso for tailoring clothes, on a stand, exactly of the elderly Mrs. Smith. This he naturally referred to as Mrs. Smith. It remained one of the items to clean out of the Bonneville warehouse storage, along with the Dahlenbach's 1954 Lincoln. Dave's proposal was to leave the representative figure of Mrs. Smith in the back seat of the car to its next destination. Basically, apropos of the characterization you just heard. To round out the show, I am going to play for you one of the versions of Dave relating Christmas in Australia, which in this instance never really gets to Christmas itself in Australia, but in which Dave talks about his agricultural high school and, somewhat uniquely, describes traveling home for holiday break. Like the Southern Tea Rooms, this program about Christmas, family, and school in Australia is just one of a few tellings that each includes some different detail. In previewing the choices among the recordings I'd found so far, I've come to realize that a nice sort of written memoir, call it, say, Monk on Monk and everything else, could be edited together from the various radio programs like this one, if only given the time. So the following is Dave Monk's broadcast during the 11 a.m. hour on Christmas Day, 2005. The recording levels were rather high, so there is some distortion throughout, but I found it to be a listenable and engaging homecoming narrative. Enjoy.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT, Champaign, 90.1 on your FM dial, and by myself today. Bill is out of town, and rightly so, and I'm running the buttons, which means I might not always be right on dial, but that's okay. My theme today is going home for Christmas. I have to set you up so that you know what going home meant. My father was the last of 14 children, and my mother had two sisters, and they were all Congregationalists. My father was a minister in a Congregational church, and he met my mother there. My mother was a very good seamstress, because her father was a tailor on Savile Row, which was the street where most fancy tailors were in inner London. My mother went to the to a sort of a royal school, an old school. And they had a house that overlooked Bondi Beach, which now is a major beach in the Sydney area. But in those days was a lot of bush and shrub, and some of it I pick up in the IGA. The wax plants that in Australia become the Christmas flower that is often gathered, because it happens to be at that time of the year, because we're in
summer right now, and summertime, though, it's very hot. So right at Christmas time, you're dealing with sometimes up to 114 degrees. And that means you look for shade, and so do the dogs and other animals. If you're dealing with someone with a sulky that's going places, the dog will always run underneath the sulky and be there shaded. And mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the midday sun. So sometimes recent arrivals did go out in the midday sun and they got very burned and they suffered heat prostration. So that gives you a little bit of the atmosphere, a fast-flowing stream, which my father, if it rained, he would have to let certain children go very quickly because the fast-flowing creek would come up very quickly and cut off their log across the river, or their flat-bottom boat, which would take them home, would be too risky to use because of the fastness of the stream and the stones and things it had to move by. So you got your children home as quickly as you could. Well, father taught school. Sometimes he'd have 14 people in 6 or 7 or 8 classes. Sometimes one person to a class, sometimes no person in a class. If a road was being developed and there were a lot of people in town, you might have 45 students, and the students would live in encampments. So things were various. Mother taught sewing. She was a seamstress, and my father taught carpentry because prior to being a prelate and then being a teacher, he was a cabinet maker and had a run of different jobs, including working with a glass company and a paper factory, and various people befriended him and helped to put him through theological college. And then after about 5 years of that, he just felt he wasn't really as religious as his clientele, so he went teaching, but he always taught in a manner that he was using the institution to teach moral code and try and figure out what people were about. And he did a lot of innovative things with teaching, so sometimes educators would come by to see what Ernie Monk was doing. Ernie Monk had another side to him, which was he had a small farm. He used the local commons and the roadsides and rented some space next door to us, and we had up to 10 cows, and these cows were our pets. And there was always one young rambunctious heifer that would lead the crowd, but then there were the mature cows that came behind. And when we came out of school, we had to get on our own on horses, so we didn't have horses, but we had bicycles, so the cows would perhaps be 3 miles away. So you caught up with the little local post office, which is also the store, which is also the gas station, and found out where Monk's cows went. There was a three-way fork, and oh, somebody saw them up by Joyce's, and off you'd go and round up the cows and bring them home. We fed them well, so they came home anyway, even if you didn't go get them, but it was better to go get them. And we had a huge vegetable garden. We used to sell vegetables, used to make toys and sell them. So part of my fees for going to school were coming from the making of toys and ladders and wheelbarrows and all those sorts of things. So father was a rather complex man, and sometimes I remember the school inspector coming, and there was father with a athletic singlet on and a pair of shorts and with a scythe, and actively engaged in his alternate jobs of having a little farm and a chicken run and a forest of orchard and things like that. So when it came to high school, we had to decide whether David was going to go to high school locally or go to boarding school. Well, if you went locally, you would get up at about 6 o'clock on Monday morning, and by 12 o'clock you got to Coffs Harbor, where the nearest local high school was. By this time, you were 60 miles away from home, and you would have board for the week, and then on Friday afternoon, you would have to leave school about 2 o'clock to catch the Brisbane Express back. Then you'd have to reverse the process and arrive perhaps 6 o'clock at night or something like that. A rather arduous career, and the alternative was to go to boarding school. Well, my parents didn't have a lot of money, and the state has some boarding schools for that purpose. Three of them in the state of New South Wales are agricultural boarding schools. And well, I'd grown up with agriculture. I'd helped the local farmers. I'd been a junior farmer. I'd shown cattle. I'd judged various livestock, hogs and beef cattle and the like. So it was an enjoyable alternative to go to an agricultural high school sort of west of Sydney, about 350 miles south of where my parents were, and in an equally arid sort of situation. The Sydney Basin is a part of this whole tectonic movement, and but the basin runs back into the mountains a little bit further than it does further on the north coast. But in the Sydney Basin, a little more room. So early historic settlement was there, and I was at a school at a little place called Glenfield, and it was a 5-year high school, and there was a farm, a 400-acre farm with some adjunct space. There were farm managers, teachers, and supervisors, but basically the labor force for the farm were the students. That gave the students work experience. It gave them a lot of responsibility. So if you go as a 10 or 11 year old kid and you have to milk cows and feed them and groom horses and keep the farm machinery in operation, make sure that the hogs are fed and collect the eggs and all those chores, so we used to take it in turns. We had a roster, and every once a month you would be on squad for a week, and you'd be joined by some detention people who, the favorite deterrent for rambunctious individuals was to give them overtime. So the prefects, the senior members of the school that were the dorm supervisors, would give you so much time on a certain squad. So it depended on the nefarity of the act, whether you got 3 days on dairy or 2 days on piggery, or so there was a school uniform. On certain days, especially when there were school inspectors around, there was a uniform in code, but basically everyone wore shorts and boots and that were appropriate for farming families. A lot of the people that were there were from rural areas, farming background, and they didn't have to be told how to work the farm. They had already had that sort of experience. Others were coming from a more urban background and didn't know agriculture as much, but had an interest in it, and but they learned fairly quickly. There were other people, like orphans, Barnardo children and the like, who had been picked up and channeled to this particular type of school because it was relatively inexpensive. And some of them were streetwise, and they could always teach us a thing or two. We learned from them, and they moved on to be interesting citizens, and they were unfortunately part of the orphan system that flowed through from United Kingdoms, and they did an awful lot of work. After, or some time after I left, it was adjudicated that this was child labor, so that process stopped and they hired farmhands to do most of the farming. The farm still remained as a demo for activities that were teaching people how to farm, and there was involvement, but it was not to the same extent that it was previously. And I have to add that in vacation times, when most of the students went home, the scholarship people were the ones that milked the cows and ran the farm, and they got prestige because of that, but they didn't get as much time at home. They got a few weeks off, but they sure knew how to milk cows and work with the animals. And so neophytes who didn't know how to encourage a cow to let down milk would have to consult with scholarship people who knew well how to calm a cow down and talk to her and milk a cow and teach other students how to milk. So there you have an atmosphere a little bit. We were in 12 people dorms. You could have the best pillow fight ever. You could, we were all together, and a camaraderie. There were 240 of us that were boarders. 240 were day students. They came to the student to the school because of its agricultural bias, but they had to come inordinate distances. And so they didn't become part of the camaraderie of the boarding school very much because they couldn't afford the time to stay and play football or be a part of debating teams and the like. Some of those day students eventually became boarders because of that and were part of the whole system. Well, we're going to go home for Christmas. There's been finals at, you know, this the end of a year for us is December, and we're ready to go home. We've had our banquets, and everyone's a little edgy as to getting out of town. The state provides tickets for students, and Wednesday afternoon, when we're due to leave, we get all in a very large classroom, and the sportsmaster would dole out tickets, but he wouldn't make the first move until the 3:30 train had whooped its way to town. It was a little steam train that would go off a few miles to, it was coming through from other places. It was an urban train, but an urban steam train with no really big tender, but and a very perfunctory whistle. But we didn't have watches, so this train was, if it was on time, you knew it, and you knew what the time of day was. If you didn't hear the whistle, you had to ask someone, was the 3:30 on time today? I thought it was a little late, and somebody who was affluent enough to have a watch would verify that the 3:30 was 5 minutes late today, and so you adjusted your time schedule accordingly. And Eck was the economics teacher, but he's also the sportsmaster, and he also handled travel. And he was the economics teacher. He was the economics was the science of keeping books, and he was partially deaf, so he's very loud. But he was not deaf enough to miss the train whistle, so he would wait till the 3:30 train pulled out. He didn't want a whole bunch of high school holy terrors running around Sydney doing things that were untoward. Not that they do that. They were amazing. We well behaved, a bunch of people. But nevertheless, we had to take the next train, which was probably the 4:10, and by that time we would get to Sydney in time to go to the Central Railroad Station and hop on a train going in various directions, north, west, south, nothing east, of course, because that was the Pacific Ocean. Huge railroad station, and we knew we always had a few seniors and a few juniors and people who had been at this stunt before, and it was in the era when you still had boxcars, so little groups would assemble that were going to these various destinations. Some would go a long distance and have to get on trains like the Brisbane Express that moved for all the local stations and didn't deposit anyone for 300 miles, more or less. They would pick up but not drop people. So you had express trains and mail trains that were the next level, and then the locals. So these groups would accumulate according to where they had to go to. I had to go about 350 miles, so I got the North Coast Mail. I didn't get the Brisbane Express. That would have been only probably one or two students would have gotten that. But the train would leave about 7:20 at night, and we were ready. It was an era when there were more people than there were seats, so there was always one person in the bunch that had a specialty in metalwork, and it wasn't too hard to engineer a key to the boxcar doors. So the stunt that the railroaders had worked out was that they backed the train into the central station, and everyone would try to pile in, and they got very clever. Then they would pull the train out a few hundred yards, so we knew it was only going a few hundred yards, but the rest of the people didn't know that. So we would open a boxcar door with our key and put our freight in, and sometimes a person would ride in the car. We'd be quite innocently standing around, and when they brought the train back in again, we were in and ensconced before the attendant caught up with us. And when he did catch up with us, he was decidedly angry. He realized that someone must have a key, and who was? Nobody knew who had a key. And eventually, there was so much hubbub at the other end of the train where there were corridor cars and people got on that he had to leave us. And so we would have probably about 14 kids to a 12-seat a box car, and then we'd start to sort out our sleeping bags, and we'd have a heater in the floor. It was a chemical heater. You shook it up and it gave forth heat. Well, you'd poke that under the seat, and then you got a couple of people on the floor. The little people were up in the luggage racks, and any alcove you could get. There was the unlucky person got to be on the toilet seat. It wasn't exactly the toilet seat. It was a hard seat where you had to lift up that seat in order to get to a toilet. So every box car had a toilet. But that person also got some other liberalities because of the luck of the draw. And the bigger, heavier ones probably occupied the seats and topped and tailed. And so by the time we got to the suburbs, we were asleep. The train was usually pulled by a C-class 36 engine. It wasn't the heaviest engine, but you were traveling on the coast, and the coastal railroads are going across swampland often, and that means that the bed falls and rises according to water levels and the like, and it often means that your heavier engines would hit they would go down on one element of stick rail and hit the other one at its end, and that would make a crack in the rail, very dangerous and derailing. We used a slightly smaller engine, and as kids you were always interested in what was pulling you, and we would take off through the areas that were seaside resorts north of Sydney, over the Hawkesbury River. There was a bridge there that replaced punt. You used to have to take trains across by punt. Well, it was replaced by a bridge, but by the time I was going to school, it was very old and a little dangerous, so you had to go across the bridge at 2 miles an hour. And soon after that, they built a bigger and a better bridge. So when you go up through sort of scrawny forests where we have Hawkesbury sandstones and the like, you could, if you were at the end of the train, you could see the light of the firebox shining out as a sort of a arrow lighting up the trees that you went through. If the train went a little too fast, you could feel it start to wag its tail, and you could hear the engine driver putting on the brakes, because if you have that sort of tail wagging, it gets to have some simple harmonic motion, you can actually drop the tail off and derail. So you could always tell when the driver was going about as fast as he could go and when he was going too fast. So up and over some ridges, and by the morning the light was coming on. You could see the station masters had to give a staff. This was a single line, so each section was controlled by a staff that made sure that only one train had a staff, and if there was another train in the vicinity, it couldn't move from its situation until the other train had come through. And there was Morse code, always and that was sending messages to the next stations to say that the North Coast Mail was late, or that it would be at Coffs Harbour at a certain time. So as you got to Kempsey, that was our first start to put down. We would have a restaurant there. The railroads had beautiful restaurants, but they were always crowded. So we got very adept at dropping off the train as it was coming in. The train was probably still running at about 10 miles an hour when we'd drop off and run into the station and get it what we wanted and be out of there before the crowd got off. And it would be there for a while. You might even change engines or change crew. The crews were pretty interesting. They had a lot of responsibility. But anyway, as you got from Kempsey, you stopped at little places that only had a platform that was 6x6 and enough to put on a couple of cans of cream. You couldn't send your milk to market because it was too far. Sydney was too far away. You sent it to as cream. You separated and you sent your cream to market to a butter factory. So you'd pick up a couple of cans of cream and take it it might be 20 or 30 miles to the factory at Raleigh, and you'd make butter, which was then sent off to the preferred market of England. Grew up with very salty butter because salt was used as a preservative. And the cattle were accompanied by pigs, not hogs, pigs. And you separated the milk and then fed it to the hogs. You had a tree, you cut it down and you hollowed that out and made a trough, and you may have some scraps to go with it, you may have corn and other things, but basically you fed them sour milk. Fresh milk tended to give the pigs diarrhea, so you gave them sour milk. They enjoyed that, and the taste of ham that is from a milk-fed pig is quite different from Midwest soybean and corn-fed creature. Same if you're in the wheat belt, it's a different flavor again. But hogs were a part of the dairying industry. Beef cattle were too. A lot of milking. Some people didn't feed their cows very well, so they'd have about 60 cows and they gave a cup of milk each. Other people, we included, used to feed our cows pretty well, and you'd get quite 2 gallons of milk, and it was very interesting. So I was coming home, so I got to Raleigh. We gradually got to the point where I knew the trees, and we picked up the service bus. They'd been waiting often to playing cards on the platform, waiting for the mail to arrive a little late, and so we drove 10 miles to Bellingen and 20 miles to Bellingen, and then waited again, cut another bus, the same line, to Thora, just under the seat of the mountains. And you got out the little post office, which was also the gas station and the phone booth. And sometimes my parents would meet me at the station in their old 28 model Whippet. Sometimes we weren't even sure quite when we were coming home, so sometimes it was a surprise. I walked up the corridor to the schoolmaster's residence, and that was coming home for Christmas.
That was Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, recorded here on WEFT on December 25th, 2005. You can hear our recent shows remembering Dave Monk, the Prairie Monk, and more at the Public Affairs page at our website, weft.org. I'm Bill Saylor. Thank you for tuning in and for your support, and take care.